In continuing my conversation with Robert Burke, author of the recently released book on Marvin Miller, we discuss the case of Curt Flood and the major steps toward free agency. What turned out to be his pinnacle of his career, among the many things he did, was the overturning of the Reserve Clause in 1975, which ended the owner's ability to run a plantation-like system with their players and could sign, you know, could sign them to perpetual one-year contracts and thus keeping the players' salaries down. This, of course, led to free agency, and the proverbial floodgates opened in terms of money. There were many steps on the road to this. One being the Curt Flood situation. Flood, a solid center fielder with the Cardinals, was going to be traded to the Phillies after the 1969 season. Flood refused, challenged the Reserve Clause, and then sued Major League Baseball. What measures did Marvin Miller seek to end the Reserve Clause, if at all, prior to Curt Flood's plea?
Okay, well, let me start with this, and that is that beginning with the first spring training after Marvin had actually been elected, in other words, spring training of 1967, Marvin, as early as that, when he was holding meetings with individual squads, would tell them, in our reading, my reading and that of Dick Moss, our counsel, our reading of the Reserve Clause is that this is only a one-year reserve. That, as we read the Reserve Clause, if you play out 1 year without a contract, your option year, your reserve year, that then, as we read the language of the Reserve Clause that was in every player's standard contract, then you have the right to be a free agent and sign with anyone, any club that you want to. That's how, so he was telling players this as early as 1967.
Okay.
And part of the reason that he was doing this is he's setting the stage for players collectively at some point to want to take this issue on. He also had, and that he could point this out, the fact that by the end of the 1960s, even before Flood, you'd had just such rulings in federal court in the case of the NBA, in the case of Rick Barry, and his desire to, become a free agent and sign with another club and even another league, as the case turned out. Mm-hmm. So, but Marvin also believed that because of baseball's antitrust exemption, and again here, he'd read up on these things himself for some time. He also had Dick Moss at his side, who was his brilliant attorney, that baseball would be a much tougher nut to crack through the courts. I think Marvin always viewed the Flood case as something that on principle the union should back, but that he recognized from the outset that the odds of Flood succeeding were virtually nil.
Yeah.
This is why, when I mentioned this building block by building block, step by step approach, what Marvin thought was good, I think from the outset, would be a more fruitful avenue to try to bring about the modification of the Reserve Clause as owners had interpreted, was first of all to get a grievance arbitration system in place in which the final arbiter was not the commissioner, but an independent arbiter, mm-hmm. much like what Marvin had done himself in the war years. And that if you could then get a player to test the owner's definition of the reserve by being willing to play out the option year and then file a grievance. But you see, to file a grievance and have a chance of winning that, you've got to have that independent grievance arbitration system in place first. And he got that in 1970. The same year that, of course, the Flood case is working its way to the courts. You know, Marvin's view about the Flood case, I think, would have been that, hey, if this succeeds, we've preempted what we think is more likely to be the process by which we can get to the end result. The other thing that I think played a strong role, though, in getting eventually succeeding in getting the owner's definition of the reserve clause struck down is that you had to get, as I said, first of all, the grievance arbitration system in place. Then you had to be able to persuade a player to be willing to play out the option year, to refuse to be bought off by a last-ditch, you know, lucrative contract offer. Mm-hmm. And to be able to get a player to do that, you had to have, through some other means, an example that you could point to with players and say, this is what you would be worth in an open market. And this is where I think a crucial step, maybe as crucial as the Curt Flood lawsuit in terms of at least raising awareness about the reserve clause, was the Catfish Hunter case. Because what the Catfish Hunter case, of course, was a grievance arbitration case in which Charlie Finley was accused, correctly, of having violated the terms of Catfish Hunter's claim contract by refusing to make required payments to an insurance, to an annuity fund. When Hunter won that grievance before a three-person grievance arbitration panel in which Marvin's the union representative on that panel, John Guerin, the owner's negotiator, is the management representative, and then you have the independent arbitrator, Peter Seitz, as being the deciding vote on the panel. When Hunter won that case, and then as a consequence received what at the time was an enormous contract from the New York Yankees, mm-hmm. Then, even though the source of the grievance hadn't been the reserve clause directly, but that Finley had violated the terms of Hunter's contract, nonetheless, I don't think it's an accident that in the year following the Hunter contract, that's when you finally get two players who are willing to go all the way through the process. Yep. Wait out an entire option season, and then file a grievance challenging the reserve clause directly. And, I mean, that example of how much they worked, my God, you know, it's like players at the time when they saw the contract Hunter got, they thought, geez, this is what we can possibly expect if we do win a grievance arbitration case that's a direct challenge to the reserve. In fact, if anything, The one thing that the Flood case did do was that in the collective bargaining agreement in 1970, the union had agreed to not file a grievance arbitration case against the reserve as long as the Flood case was still in litigation. So the union, in effect, couldn't try to get somebody to do a grievance arbitration challenge to the reserve until the Supreme Court had made its decision in Flood's case. Mm-hmm. So again, if Flood had proved successful, then obviously that would have removed the need for a grievance arbitration candidate to test the reserve. But as long as that case was in litigation, the union, in a collective bargaining agreement, in an active collective bargaining agreement, had said, well, we won't try to grieve the removal of the reserve clause. So, again, what all of this points to is how these, what seemed like baby steps, singles, as Marvin would tell them to players, singles after singles, rather than going for the home run at the outset, is what lays the foundation for the success that they enjoyed.
So ultimately, in 1975, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally, at the behest of Miller, played the entire season without contracts, and after the season would go before a three-person arbitration hearing, Peter Seiss, the independent arbitrator, voted in favor of the players. He was the deciding vote. With that, the death of the reserve clause, the birth of free agency. And you just mentioned it, the Catfish Hunter decision probably played a big influence and helped convince both Messersmith and McNally to play out the entire year as free agents. Because otherwise, it would have been a big risk. I mean McNally, I think, was going to retire, but...
Well, that's the thing. McNally had retired. Okay. That was the funny thing about it, is that under the owner's understanding of the reserve clause, McNally had been signed to a contract with Montreal. He'd been traded to Montreal. He'd been promised by Montreal that if he accepted the trade and went to Montreal, he'd receive a two-year contract when he, and on that understanding, verbal understanding, he accepted the trade, and then Montreal went back on their promise to him. So what McNally then did that year was, and he was basically, his career was essentially over as it turned out. He recognized after spring training that he no longer could be an effective pitcher. He retired. But under the owner's definition of the reserve clause, even if you retired, you were still under the control of the club that had had you last. In other words, this was the way the owners were going to protect themselves against somebody retiring in quotation marks and then after a certain period of time trying to sign a contract with another club. No, using that as a ruse, in other words. Well, McNally wasn't using it as a ruse. He actually had retired, gone to back home to Billings, Montana, had a car dealership there. But again, here again is where Marvin's leadership of the union and the rapport he developed with players, and particularly the team and league reps within the union, mattered. Because Marvin couldn't believe, nor could Dick Moss, that Andy Messersmith, the other potential grievance candidate, that the Dodgers wouldn't move heaven and earth to sign him before the end of the option season. And the reason they weren't sure that Messersmith would remain unsigned until after the season was over when the grievance could be filed is that in Messersmith's case, it wasn't so much about the dollars that was the reason for his holding out from signing a new contract. What he wanted was a multi-year deal with a no-trade clause. And by later in the season, the Dodgers, who had up to that point refused to offer either, said, okay, we don't want to do it, but, and again, with the urgings of John Guerin and their legal advisors and stuff, who are basically screaming at the Dodgers, get this guy signed, we don't want a test of the reserve clause. The Dodgers said, okay, well, we'll agree to a two-year contract, but we still refuse the no-trade clause. And so when the Dodgers changed their stance to that extent, but not further, Marvin couldn't believe that the Dodgers would hold to that position. He thought eventually they'll agree to a no-trade clause because, in other words, they're willing to let this guy go unsigned and potentially therefore be a grievance arbitration candidate testing the reserve over a non-monetary issue. A non-monetary issue for the Dodgers. Just the unwillingness to grant a no-trade clause. And so because of that, the union and Marvin thought we'd better have a fallback reserve clause tester in case the Dodgers do agree to a no-trade clause for Andy. So then they contact McNally, who's still seething at the fact that Montreal had not been honest with him to begin with. And McNally had been a union rep. McNally had been an Oriole team rep. So again, he'd been a union loyalist. He felt he'd been done wrong by Montreal when they promised him a two-year contract and then afterwards reneged on it. Joe McNally, after he talks to Marvin, he says, "Okay, look, I'm willing to put my name in as a grievance arbitration person if you need me." And it says something about the honesty of Dave McNally, which I think needs to be appreciated by people, that when Montreal, their owner, rushed out to Billings, Montana to try to persuade him to sign a contract after they learned that he was also going to be a reserve clause challenger. In other words, just like with Messersmith, you know, management lawyers are saying to Montreal's owner, "You better get your butt out to Billings and sign this guy to a contract." Mm. And to McNally's credit, he refused to sign a contract, even one that would have given him a signing bonus, even if he proved to not make the club the following year. McNally said, "It wouldn't be right for me to take a signing bonus money when I know in my heart I'm retired and I have no intention of playing again. You know, that would be taking money, you know, unethically on my part." So if he had done that, all he would have been doing was taking $25,000 signing bonus, not intending to play again, but by doing so, he would have deprived the union of his availability as a plaintiff, so to speak, in the grievance arbitration. So I have enormous admiration for Dave McNally for how he handled that situation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he then provided a second plaintiff. Ironically, then, once the Dodgers heard about that, they even withdrew the multi-year contract offer to Messersmith because they knew even if they came to terms with Messersmith, there'd be a grievance arbitration case.
When the arbitrator finally agreed with the union that an owner could only control a player for 1 year, the time had come to negotiate a whole new system, and the owners panicked. They could not picture living under a system in which every player would be a free agent every year.
Miller shrewdly offered the owners what seemed on the surface a compromise. Players would not be eligible for free agency until they had played 6 years. The owners gratefully agreed. At least they could still control their most valuable assets for a time. But baseball would never be the same again. The law of supply and demand now favored the players.
It's safe to say that Marvin Miller is on the Mount Rushmore of impactful individuals on baseball history. Babe Ruth, Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey are probably the others. There are so many aspects of today's game that still have his fingerprints. Player salaries, of course, it's gone up exponentially, and that's not just because of inflation. The hot stove league not only gives players a chance to negotiate their contracts and find teams willing to pay them more, but it also gives fans a chance to follow and talk about the sport in the dead of winter like we are right now. Could Marvin Miller have had this kind of impact on another league, say the NFL or the NBA?
Short answer, I would say, is yes. I don't think that the other professional sports were fundamentally different in terms of his ability to have made the kind of impact he did. I think, obviously, Marvin had more of a familiarity with baseball than with other sports, and, of course, the timing of him being approached through intermediaries about the baseball opening meant that that's the one that was available at a time when he felt that his security at the Steelworkers Union was no longer as great as it once had been. There had been a change in the union's top leadership, the union election that had voted out the man who had been the head of the Steelworkers during virtually all the time Marvin had been there, and his replacement was someone who was less supportive of Marvin and others like him in the union than David McDonald had been. So the the fact was that the opening occurred at a time when Marvin was ready to jump, and baseball was the union that was the industry where the opportunity arose. But Marvin was certainly would have been more comfortable with that because he'd grown up a baseball fan. He'd always been a baseball fan, and I don't think he had as much emotional attachment to other professional sports. Now, having said that, in retirement, he would offer advice to the leaders of other sports unions. As well as other unions in baseball, whether it be the umpires union or whatever. We also have to add the fact that while Marvin, I think, could have had a similar impact in another individual industry as far as its major league, top level union was concerned, I think he would have encountered the same difficulties or the same unwillingness on the part of the membership in other sports as well, an unwillingness to view their own union as anything more than a union of the top level performers in that particular sport in America. In other words, what Marvin created, for better and for worse in terms of the limitations of what it could do, is he was able to create an effective, what amounts to an AFL-style craft union of the highest ranking and ultimately highest paid employees, player employees, in that particular sport. The membership of the Baseball Players Association never developed an interest in expanding the baseball union to encompass minor league players or even major league baseball employees who were not ball players, or to try to create a sports, multi-sport industrial style union like we think of in other parts of the American economy. What Marvin achieved was within those limited parameters. But what's remarkable, I think, ultimately, is that within those limited parameters, he was so successful that other unions, to lesser degrees, were able, by the baseball union's example, to piggyback on that. And so while the NFL Players Union or the NHL Players Union or, the other major sports unions are, even with the setbacks of more recent years, they're still, by the Players Union, the Baseball Players Union is still far and away, I think, the most powerful and most effective union in sports. But at least by their example, they did serve, I think, to help pull some of those other industries and the treatment of their players upward, albeit not to the same extent. That's not a bad legacy for Marvin Miller to be able to claim.
A great thank you to Robert Burke for his extensive insight on one of baseball's true power players. For Baseball As It Was, I'm Brian Wright.